sharp penknife at the bottom of a deep spring. I began talking again, this time with frequent pauses. My question is, what was your purpose in painting that picture? Its subject matter, its structure, and its style are so different from your other works. It makes me think you were using it to communicate a very personal message. What is the painting's underlying meaning? Who is killing whom? Who is the Commendatore? Who is the murderer, Don Giovanni? And who is that mysterious bearded fellow with the long face poking his head out of the ground in the lower left-hand corner? The Commendatore raised his hand again. I drew up short. Enough questions, he said. It will take a while for those to permeate. Will he be able to answer? Does he have enough strength left? No, the Commendatore said, shaking his head. I doubt my friends will obtain answers. He does not have the energy for that. Then why did you have me ask? What my friends imparted were not questions, but information. That my friends had found Killing Commendatore in the attic. That its existence was known to my friends. It is the first step. Everything begins from there. Then what is the second step? When my friends slay me, of course. It is the second step. And is there a third step? There should be, of course. Then what is it? Have you still not figured this out, my friends? No, I haven't. By reenacting the allegory contained within that painting, we shall lure Longface into the open, into this room. By dragging him out, my friends shall win back Maria Akikawa. I was speechless. What world had I stepped into? There seemed no rhyme or reason to it. It is a hard thing without question, the Commendatore intoned. Yet there is no alternative. Hence my friends must dispatch me now, without further ado. We waited for the information I had given Tomohiko Amada to complete its journey to his brain. That took some time. Meanwhile, I tried to put to rest some of my doubts by peppering the Commendatore with questions. Why, I asked, did Tomohiko Amada remain silent about what had happened in Vienna even after the war had ended? I mean, no one was standing in his way at that point. The woman he loved was brutally executed by the Nazis, the Commendatore answered. Slowly tortured to death. Their comrades were slain in a similar fashion. In the end, their plot was a wretched failure. Only through the offices of the Japanese and German governments did he barely escape with his life. The experience savaged him. He had been arrested and detained by the Gestapo for 2 months. They subjected him to extreme torture. Their violence was unspeakable, but they took care not to kill him, nor to leave any physical scars. Yet their sadism left his nerves in tatters, and as a result, something within him was extinguished. Placed under the strictest orders, he bowed to the inevitable and remained silent. Then he was forcibly repatriated to Japan. Not long before, I said, Tomohiko Amada's younger brother had taken his own life, probably because of the trauma of his own war experience. He had been part of the Nanjing massacre and committed suicide right after his discharge from the army, correct? Affirmative. Tomohiko Amada lost many loved ones in the whirlpool of those years. He himself was sorely damaged. As a result, his anger and grief put down deep roots, the hopeless, impotent realization that no matter what he did, he could not stand against the torrent of history. As the sole survivor, he must also have felt an immense guilt. Hence, he never spoke a word of what happened in Vienna, even after the gag was removed. It is as though he was unable to speak. I looked at Tomohiko Amada's face, but I could detect no reaction as yet. I couldn't tell if he heard us or not. I spoke. Then, at some point, we don't know exactly when, he created Killing Commendatore, an allegorical painting that expressed all he could not say. He put everything into it, a brilliant tour de force. He took that which he had been unable to accomplish in reality, the Commendatore said, and gave it another form, what we might call camouflaged expression. Not of what had in fact happened, but of what should have happened. Nevertheless, he bundled the painting up tight and hid it in the attic, out of public view, I said. Although he had radically transformed the events, they were still too raw to reveal. Is that what you mean? Precisely. It distills the pure essence of his living spirit. Then, one day, my friends happened upon it. So are you saying all of this began when I brought the painting out into the light? Is that what you meant by opening the circle? The Commendatore said nothing, just extended his hands, palms up. Not long after, we noticed Tomohiko Amada's face turning pink. The Commendatore and I had been watching him closely for any change. At the same time, as if in response, the small mysterious light that had been flickering deep in his eyes began to rise slowly to the surface, like an ascending deep sea diver gauging the effects of the water pressure on his body. The veil covering Amada's eyes also lifted, until, finally, both were wide open. The person lying before us was no longer a frail, desiccated old man on the verge of death. Instead, he was someone whose eyes brimmed with a determination to hang on to this world as long as he could. He is gathering his remaining strength, the Commendatore said to me, recovering as much of his conscious mind as he is able, but the more he regains mentally, the greater the physical torment. His body has been secreting a special substance to blot out that pain. It is thanks to the existence of such a substance that people can die in peace, not in agony. When consciousness returns, so does the pain. Nevertheless, he is trying to recover as much as he can. This is a mission he must fulfill here and now, however great the suffering. As if to reinforce the Commendatore's words, Tomohiko Amada's face began to contort with agony. Age and infirmity had eaten away at his body until it was ready to shut down. He could feel that now. There was no way to avoid it. The end of his allotted time was fast approaching. It was painful to watch him suffer. Instead of calling him back, I might better have let him die a peaceful, painless death in a semi-conscious haze. But he chose this way himself, the Commendatore said, again reading my mind. It is painful to witness, but beyond our control. Won't Masahiko be returning soon? I asked the Commendatore. Negative, not for some time, he said with a small shake of his head. His call was work-related, something important. He will be gone a considerable time. Tomohiko's eyes were wide open. They had been sunk within their wrinkled sockets, but now his eyeballs protruded like a person leaning out of a window. His breathing was deeper and more ragged. It rasped as it passed in and out of his throat, and he was staring straight at the Commendatore. There was no doubt. The Commendatore was visible to him. Amazement was written in his face. He couldn't believe what was sitting in front of him. How could a figure produced by his imagination appear before him in reality? Negative. That is not the case, the Commendatore said. What he sees and what my friends see are completely different. You mean you don't look the same way to him? My friends, keep in mind that I am an idea. My form changes depending on the person and the situation. Then how do you look to Mr. Amada? That is something even I do not know. I am like a mirror that reflects what is in a person's heart, nothing more. But you assumed this form for me on purpose, didn't you? Choosing to appear as the commendatore? To be precise, I did not choose this form. Cause and effect are hard to separate here. Because I took the form of a commendatore, a sequence of events was set in motion. But at the same time, my form is the necessary consequence of that very sequence. It is hard to explain using the concept of time that governs the world you live in, my friends, but it might be summed up as, all these events have been determined beforehand. If an idea is a mirror, then is Tomohiko Amada now seeing what he wishes to see? Negative! He is seeing what he must see, the commendatore corrected me. It may be excruciating, yet he must look. Now, at the end of his life. I examined Tomohiko Amada's face again. Mixed with the amazement, I could discern an intense loathing, and almost unendurable torment. The return to consciousness carried with it not only the agony of the flesh, it brought with it the agony of the soul. He is squeezing out every last ounce of strength to ascertain who I am, despite the pain. He is striving to return to his 20s. Tomohiko Amada's face had turned a fiery red. Hot blood coursed through his veins. His thin, dry lips trembled. He gasped violently. His long, skeletal fingers clutched at the sheets. Stop dithering, my friends, and kill me now, while his mind is whole, the commendatore said. The quicker, the better. He may not be able to hold himself together much longer. The commendatore drew his sword from its scabbard. It was just 8 inches long, but it looked very sharp indeed. Despite its dimensions, it was a weapon capable of ending a person's life. Stab me with this, the commendatore said. We shall recreate the scene from killing commendatore. But hurry, there is no time to dawdle. I looked back and forth from the commendatore to Tomohiko Amada, struggling to make up my mind. All I could be remotely sure of was that Tomohiko Amada was in desperate need, and the commendatore's resolve was firm. I alone wallowed in indecision, caught between the two of them. I felt the rush of owl wings and heard a bell ring in the dark. Everything was connected somewhere. Affirmative! Everything is connected somewhere, said the commendatore. And my friends cannot escape that connection, however my friends may try. So steel yourself and kill me. There is no room for guilt. Tomohiko Amada needs your help. By slaying me, my friends can save him. Make happen here what should have happened in the past. Now is the time. Only my friends can grant him salvation before he breathes his last. I rose from my chair and strode to where the commendatore was seated. I took his unsheathed sword in hand. I was past the point of determining what was just and unjust. In a world outside space and time, all dualities, before and after, up and down, ceased to exist. In such a world, I could no longer perceive myself as myself. I and myself were being torn apart. The instant I took the sword in hand, however, I realized its handle was too small. It was a miniature sword for a tiny hand. There was simply no way could I kill the commendatore with it, however keen its blade. The realization brought with it a sense of relief. The sword is too small. I can't grip it, I said to the commendatore. That is a shame, he said with a sigh. Well, there is nothing to be done. We must use something else. although that means diverging further from the painting. Something else? The Commendatore pointed to a small chest of drawers in the corner of the room. Look inside the top drawer. I went to the chest and slid open the uppermost drawer. Within is a knife for filleting fish, the Commendatore said. Sure enough, a knife lay atop a small stack of neatly folded washcloths, the knife that Masahiko had used to prepare the sea bream he had brought to my home, an 8-inch blade honed to a razor's edge. Masahiko always kept his tools in perfect shape. This knife was no exception. Now take that knife and plunge it into my chest, said the Commendatore. Sword or knife, what is the difference? We can still reenact the scene in killing Commendatore, but we must make haste. There is little time. I took the knife in hand. It was as heavy as stone. The tip of the blade shone cold and white in the light streaming from the window. The knife had vanished from my kitchen and come to wait for me here in the chest of drawers. Masahiko had sharpened the blade, as it turned out, for the sake of his own father. There seemed no way to avoid my fate. I still couldn't come to a decision. Nevertheless, I stepped behind the Commendatore's chair, gripped the knife tightly in my right hand. From his bed, Tomohiko Amada stared at us with eyes as big as saucers, as if watching history unfold before his eyes. His mouth was open, exposing his yellowed teeth and whitish tongue, a tongue that lolled in his mouth as though trying to form words, words this world would never hear. My friends do not have a violent bone in your body, the Commendatore said, as if to admonish me. It is obvious. My friends are not built to kill, but sometimes people must act against their nature to rescue something important or for some greater purpose. Now is one of those times. So kill me! I am not big, as my friends can see, and I will not resist. I am merely an idea. Just insert the tip of the knife into my heart. What could be more straightforward? The Commendatore pointed his tiny index finger at the spot where his heart was. But the thought of that heart inevitably recalled my sister's. I could remember her operation as if it were yesterday. How delicate and difficult it had been. Saving a malfunctioning heart was a formidable task. It required a team of specialists and gallons of blood. Yet destroying a heart was so easy. Such thinking will get us nowhere, the Commendatore said. If my friends wish to save Maria Akikawa, then do the deed, even if my friends do not want to. Trust me, jettison all feelings and close your mind, but not your eyes. My friends must keep them open. I stepped behind the Commendatore and raised the knife, but I couldn't bring it down. Sure, it might be only one of 1,000 deaths for an idea, but it was still extinguishing a life as far as I was concerned. Was this not the same order the young lieutenant had given Sugihiko Amada in Nanjing? Negative! It is not the same, said the Commendatore. My friends are doing this at my behest. It is I who am asking my friends to kill me, so that I may be reborn. Be strong. Close the circle at once. I closed my eyes and thought of the girl I had throttled in the love hotel in Miyagi. Of course, she and I had been pretending. I had squeezed her throat gently so as not to kill her. I had been unable to do it long enough to satisfy her. Had I continued, I might indeed have strangled her to death. On the bed of that love hotel, I had glimpsed the deep rage within myself for the first time. It had churned in my chest like blood-soaked mud, pushing me closer and closer to real murder. I know where you were and what you were doing, the man had said. All right, now bring it down, the commendatore said. I know my friends can do it. Remember, my friends will not be killing me. My friends will be slaying your evil father. The blood of your evil father shall soak into the earth. My evil father? Where did that come from? Who is the evil father of my friends? The commendatore said, reading my mind. I believe your path crossed with his not long ago. Am I mistaken? Do not paint my portrait any further, the man had said. He had pointed his finger at me from within the dark mirror. It had pierced my chest like the tip of a sharp sword. Spurred by that pain, I reflexively closed my heart and opened my eyes wide. I cleared all thought from my mind, as Don Giovanni had done in killing Commendatore, buried my emotions, made my face a blank mask, and brought the knife down with all my might. The sharp blade entered the Commendatore's tiny chest precisely where he had pointed. I felt the living flesh resist, but the Commendatore himself made no attempt to fend off the blow. His fingers clutched at the air, but apart from that, he did not react. Still, the body he inhabited did all that it could to avoid its looming extinction. The Commendatore was an idea, but his body was not. An idea may have borrowed it for its own purposes, but that body would not meekly submit to death. It possessed its own rationale. I had to overcome that resistance through brute force, severing its life at the roots. Kill me, the Commendatore had said, but I was actually dispatching another someone's body. I wanted to drop the knife, drop everything, and run from the room. But the Commendatore's words echoed in my ears. If my friends wish to save Maria Akikawa, then do the deed, even if my friends do not want to. So I pushed the blade even farther into the Commendatore's heart. If you're stabbing someone to death, there's no halfway. The tip of the knife emerged from his back. I had run him through. His white garment was dyed crimson. My hands were drenched in blood. But the blood did not spew into the air as it did in killing Commendatore. This is an illusion, I tried to convince myself. I was murdering a mere phantom. My act was purely symbolic. Yet I knew I was fooling myself. Perhaps the act was symbolic, but it was no phantom that I was killing. Without question, my victim was made of flesh and blood. It may have been barely 2 feet tall, a fabrication created by Tomohiko Amada's brush, but its life force was unexpectedly strong. The point of my blade had broken the skin and several ribs on its way to the heart, then passed through to the back of the chair. No way that was an illusion. Tomohiko Amada's eyes were open even wider now, riveted on the scene unfolding before him. My murder of the Commendatore. No, for him it must have been the murder of someone else. Who was he seeing? The Nazi official whose assassination he had helped plot in Vienna? The young lieutenant who had given his brother a Japanese sword and ordered him to behead 3 Chinese prisoners in Nanjing? Or that evil something, something more fundamental that lay at the root of those events? I could only guess. I could not read the expression on Tomohiko Amada's face. Though his mouth gaped open, his lips were motionless. Only his tongue continued its futile quest to form words of some kind. At last, the strength left the commendatore's neck and arms. His whole body went slack, like a marionette whose strings had been cut. I responded by pushing the knife even farther into his heart. All movement in the room came to a standstill. The scene was now a frozen tableau. It stayed that way for a long time. Tomohiko Amada was the first to move. Once the commendatore had lost consciousness and collapsed, the strength to focus his mind evaporated. He sighed deeply and closed his eyes. Slowly and solemnly, like lowering the shutters, as if to confirm, "Now I have seen what I needed to see." His mouth was still open, but his lolling tongue was tucked out of sight. Only his yellow teeth were visible, like a ramshackle fence circling an empty house. His face was free of pain. The torment had passed. He looked peaceful and relaxed. I guessed he was back in the twilight world, where thought and pain did not exist. I was happy for him. I finally relaxed my arm and drew the blade from the commendatore's body. Blood spewed from the wound, exactly as in killing commendatore. The commendatore himself spilled lifelessly into the chair. His eyes were open, his mouth contorted in agony. His 10 tiny fingers clawed the air. Dark blood pooled around his feet. He was dead. How much blood had come from that tiny body? Thus did the commendatore, or the idea that had taken his form, meet his end. Tomohiko Amada had sunk back into his deep sleep. Standing next to the commendatore's body, Masahiko's bloody knife in my right hand, I was the only conscious person left in the room. My labored breathing should have been the only sound, should have been, but something was moving. I sensed it as much as I heard it, to my alarm. "Keep your ears open," the commendatore had told me. I did as he had instructed. "Something is in the room." I could hear it moving. Bloody knife in hand, I stood frozen like a statue, scanning the room, searching for the source of the sound. Out of the corner of one eye, I spotted something near the far wall. Long Face was there. Killing the commendatore had lured Long Face into this world. Chapter 52. The Man in the Orange Cone Hat. The scene in the room now matched the lower left-hand corner of Tomohiko Amada's killing commendatore. Long Face had poked his head out of a hole and was raising its square cover with one hand as he peeked at what was taking place. His hair was long and tangled, and a thick black beard covered much of his face. His elongated head was shaped like a Japanese eggplant, narrow with a jutting chin and bulging eyes. The bridge of his nose was flat. For some reason, his lips glistened like a piece of fruit. His body was small but well-proportioned, as if a normal person had been shrunk in size, just as the commendatore made you think of a scaled-down copy of a human being. The big difference between the long face and killing commendatore and here was his expression. Now he looked stunned as he stared at the lifeless body of the commendatore. His mouth gaped in disbelief. How long had he been watching us? I had no idea. I had been so focused on snuffing out the commendatore's life and gauging Tomohiko Amada's reaction to his death that I had been oblivious to the odd-looking man in the corner of the room. Yet I bet he hadn't missed a thing. After all, that was the scene in Killing Commendatore. Long Face remained completely still, there in the corner of our tableau, as if assigned a fixed position. I moved slightly to see how he would respond, but Long Face didn't react. He maintained the same position he had in the painting, one hand holding up the square lid, his eyes round as he gawked at the slain Commendatore. He didn't even blink. As the tension drained from my body, I moved from my own assigned position. I edged cautiously toward Longface, deadening my footsteps like a cat, the bloody knife in one hand. I could not let him slip back underground. To save Maria Akikawa, the Commendatore had given his life to recreate the scene in the painting and drawn Longface out into the open. I must not allow that sacrifice to be in vain. Yet how could I wrest from Longface what I needed to know about Maria? I was at a loss. Who or what was Longface? How was his presence linked to Maria's disappearance? What the Commendatore had told me was more riddle than information. One thing was clear, though. I had to get my hands on him. I could figure the rest out later. The lid that Longface was holding was about 2 feet square, made of the same lime green linoleum as the rest of the floor. When closed, it would blend in perfectly, perhaps even disappear altogether. Longface did not move a muscle as I approached. He seemed rooted to the spot, like a cat in the headlights, or maybe he was just fulfilling his designated role, to maintain the composition of the painting for as long as possible. Whichever, it was lucky for me. Otherwise, he would have sensed me behind him and slipped back underground for good. Once the lid had been closed, I doubted it would open again. I crept behind him, softly laid down the knife, and snatched his collar with both hands. He was wearing drab, snug-fitting clothes, work clothes from the look of it, clearly different from the fine cloth of the Commendatore's garments. These looked rough to the touch and were covered in patches. Jolted from his trance, Longface thrashed about, desperately attempting to flee down his hole. I held tight to his collar. There was no way I was going to let him escape. I gathered my strength and tried to yank him all the way out. He fought back, grabbing the sides of the hole with both hands. He was much stronger than I'd anticipated. He even tried to bite my arm. What could I do? I slammed his eggplant-shaped head against the corner of the opening. Then I did it again, this time more violently. The second blow knocked him out cold. I could feel his body go limp. At last, I could drag him out into the light. Longface was a little bigger than the Commendatore. 2.5 feet tall was my guess. He was wearing what a farmer might have worn in the fields, or a manservant sweeping the yard. A stiff, rough jacket over baggy work pants cinched at the ankles. His belt was a thick piece of rope. He wore no shoes, and his soles were thickly calloused and stained black with dirt. His long hair showed no sign of having been recently washed or combed. Half his face was covered by a black beard. The other half was a sickly white. Nothing about him looked clean, yet strangely, his body had no odor. Based on appearance, I figured the Commendatore belonged to the aristocracy of his time, while Longface was lower class. Perhaps he was dressed the way commoners did back then, or maybe Tomohiko Amada had imagined this is how people might have dressed in the Asuka period. Historical accuracy, however, was beside the point. What I needed to do was squeeze from this man with the strange face any information that would lead me to Maria. I rolled Longface over onto his stomach and tied his hands behind him with the belt of a bathrobe hanging close by. Then I dragged his motionless body to the center of the room. Because of his size, he wasn't very heavy. About the weight of a medium-sized dog. I grabbed a curtain tie and bound one of his legs to the bed. Now he had no way to flee. Stretched out unconscious in the bright afternoon light, Longface just looked pitiful. Gone was the weirdness that had alarmed me when he had poked his head up out of his hole, observing events with those glittering eyes. I could find nothing sinister about him. He didn't look bright enough to be evil. Instead, he looked honest in a dull-witted sort of way. And timid, too. Not like someone who concocted plans and made decisions, but rather the type who meekly followed his superior's orders. Tomohiko Amada was still stretched out on the bed, his eyes closed. He was completely still. I couldn't tell, looking at him, if he was alive or dead. I leaned down and put my ear less than an inch from his mouth. His breathing was faint, like a distant surf. He wasn't dead yet, just sleeping on the floor of his twilight world. I felt relieved. I didn't like the idea of Masahiko returning from his phone call to find that his father had died in his absence. Tomohiko's face, as he lay on his side, looked far more peaceful and satisfied than before. Maybe witnessing the slaying of the Commendatore, or someone else he wished to see killed, had put some of his painful memories to rest. The Commendatore was slumped in his cloth chair. His eyes were wide open, and I could see his tiny tongue curled behind his parted lips. Blood was still seeping from the wound in his chest, but the flow was weaker than before. His right hand flopped lifelessly when I took it. Although his skin retained some warmth, it felt remote and somehow detached. The kind of detachment life acquires as it moves steadily toward its own end. I felt like straightening his limbs and placing him in a proper-sized coffin, one made for a small child. I would lay the coffin in the pit behind the shrine, where no one could bother him again. But all I could do now was gently close his eyes. I sat in the chair and watched Longface on the floor, as I waited for him to regain his senses. Outside the window, the broad Pacific sparkled. A few fishing boats were still plying the waters. I could see the sleek fuselage of an airplane shining in the sun as it slowly made its way south. A four-prop plane with an antenna jutting up from its tail, probably an anti-submarine aircraft from the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force Base in Atsugi. Some of us were quietly going about our business on a Saturday afternoon. I, for one, was in a sunlit room in an upscale nursing home, having just slain the Commendatore and fished out and tied up Longface in my quest to find a beautiful 13-year-old girl. It takes all kinds, I guess. Longface didn't regain consciousness for some time. I checked my watch again. What would Masahiko think if he came back now? The Commendatore in a pool of blood, Longface bound and unconscious on the floor. Both in the unfamiliar garb of an ancient time, neither standing even 3 feet tall. Tomohiko Amada, comatose on the bed, a faint but satisfied smile, if that's what it was, on his lips. A square black hole gaping in a corner of the room. How could I explain what had led to this scene? Of course, Masahiko didn't come back. He was tied up in a work-related phone call of great importance, as the Commendatore had said. He would be dealing with it for some time yet. Everything had been arranged in advance. No one would bother us. I sat on the chair, eyeing the unconscious Longface. I had whacked his head pretty hard on the edge of the hole, but it shouldn't take him that long to come to. He'd have a fair-sized lump on his head, that's all. At last, Long Face woke up. He twisted and turned a bit on the floor and uttered a few incomprehensible words. Then, slowly, he opened his eyes a crack, like a child looking at something scary, something he didn't want to see but must. I went and knelt beside him. "There's very little time," I said, looking down at him. "I need you to tell me where I can find Maria Akikawa. If you do, I'll untie you and you can go back." I pointed to the square hole in the corner. The lid was still raised. I couldn't tell if he understood what I was saying or not, but I decided to keep talking. All I could do was give it a shot. Long Face violently shook his head back and forth several times. I couldn't tell if he was saying that he didn't know anything or that my language was foreign to him. "If you don't tell me, I'll kill you," I said. "You saw me stab the Commendatore, I bet. Well, there's no big difference between one murder and two." I pressed the bloody blade of my knife against his dirty throat. I thought of the fisherman and the pilot of the southbound airplane. We all have jobs we have to do. And this was mine. I wasn't going to kill him, of course, but the knife was real and very sharp. Long Face quivered in fear.
"Wait," he gasped in a husky voice. "Stay your hand."
His way of speaking was strange, but I could understand him. I eased off on the knife. "Where is Maria Akikawa?" I pressed him.
"Come on, spit it out." "No, sir. I do not know. I swear it."
I studied his eyes. They were big and easy to read. He seemed to be telling the truth.
"All right, then. Tell me. What are you doing here?" I asked. "I am enjoined to verify and record these events. I do only what I am told to do. You have my word."
"Why must you verify them?"
"Because I was so bidden. I know nothing beyond that."
"So what on earth are you? Another kind of idea?"
"Goodness, no. I am a metaphor, nothing more."
"A metaphor?"
"Yes, a mere metaphor, used to link two things together. So please, untie my bonds, please, I beseech you."
I was getting confused. "If you are as you say, then give me a metaphor now, off the top of your head."
"I am the most humble and lowly form of metaphor, sir. I cannot devise anything of quality."
"A metaphor of any kind is all right. It doesn't have to be brilliant."
"He was someone who stood out," he said after a moment's pause, "like a man wearing an orange cone hat in a packed commuter train."
Not an impressive metaphor, to be sure. In fact, not really a metaphor at all.
"That's a simile, not a metaphor," I pointed out. "A million pardons," he said, sweat pouring from his forehead. "Let me try again. He lived as though he were wearing an orange cone hat in a crowded train."
"That makes no sense. It's still not a true metaphor. Your story doesn't hold. I'll just have to kill you." Long Face's lips trembled with fear. His beard may have been manly, but he was short on guts.
"My sincerest apologies, sir. I am yet but an apprentice. I cannot think of a witty example, forgive me, but I assure you that I am the genuine article, a true metaphor."
"Then who is your superior? Who commands you?"
"I have no superior, per se. Well, perhaps I do, but I have never laid eyes on him. I only follow orders, acting as a link between phenomena and language, like a helpless jellyfish adrift on the ocean. So please, do not kill me. I implore you."
"I can spare your life," I said, my knife still on his throat. "But only if you agree to guide me to where you came from."
That is something I cannot do,
Long Face said in a firm voice. It was the first time he had used that tone.
The road I took to get here is the path of metaphor. It is different for each one who traverses it. It is not a single road. Thus, I cannot guide you, sir, on your way.
Let me get this straight. I must follow this path alone, and I must discover it for myself. Is that what you're saying?
Longface nodded vigorously. The path of metaphor is rife with perils. Should a mortal like you stray from the path even once, you could find yourself in danger. And there are double metaphors everywhere.
Double metaphors? Longface shuddered with fear.
Yes, double metaphors lurking in the darkness. The most vile and dangerous of creatures.
It's all the same to me, I said. I'm already mixed up in a whole lot of craziness. So it's no skin off my nose if the craziness grows or shrinks. I killed the Commendatore with my own hands. I don't want his death to be in vain.
I see I have no choice. So let me offer you a word of warning before you set out.
What kind of warning?
Take a light of some kind with you. You will pass through many dark places on your way. You will come across a river. It is a metaphorical river, but the water is very real. It is cold and deep, and the current is strong. You cannot cross without a boat. You will find a boat at the ferrying spot.
How about after I cross the river? What should I do then?
Longface rolled his bulging eyes. The world that awaits you on the other side, like this one, is subject to the principle of connectivity. You will have to see for yourself.
I checked Tomohiko Amada's bedside table. Sure enough, a flashlight was there. A facility like this one was sure to store one in each room in case of fire or earthquake. I flicked it on. The light was strong. The batteries weren't dead. I slipped on my leather jacket, which I had draped over a chair, and started for the hole in the corner, flashlight in hand.
Please, sir, Longface begged. Will you not loosen my bonds? I fear what may transpire should I be left in this state.
If you're a true metaphor, untying yourself should be easy. Aren't concepts and ideas and others like you able to move through space and time?
No, you overrate me. I am blessed with no such marvelous powers. Concepts and ideas are metaphors of a much higher order.
Like those with orange cone hats? Longface looked stricken.
Please do not mock me, sir. My feelings can be hurt too, you know.
After a moment's hesitation, I decided to untie his hands and feet. I had bound them so tightly they took time to undo. Now that we had talked, he didn't appear to be such a bad fellow. True, he didn't know where Mario was, but he had volunteered other information. I doubted that he would interfere or cause me any harm if I untied him, and I certainly couldn't leave him bound and trust where he was. Should anyone find him like that, it would only make things worse. When I finished, he sat there for a moment, rubbing his chafed wrists with tiny hands. Then he felt his forehead. It appeared a lump had already sprouted.
Thank you, sir. Now I can return to my world.
Go ahead, I said, gesturing to the hole in the corner. I'll follow later.
I shall now make my departure. Please ensure that the lid is securely closed when you follow. Otherwise, someone might trip and fall in, or grow curious and climb down. Then I would be held responsible.
Understood. I will make sure it's closed. Longface trotted to the hole and climbed inside. Then his head and shoulders popped up again. His saucer eyes had an eerie glow, as they did in killing Commendatore.
I wish you a safe journey, Longface said to me. I hope you can find, what's her name? Was it Komichi?
No, her name isn't Komichi, I said. A chill ran down my spine. My throat turned to sandpaper. I couldn't speak for a moment. The name was Maria Akikawa. Do you know something about Komichi?
No, I know nothing at all.
Longface seemed to realize that he'd let drop something he shouldn't. The name just slipped into my clumsy metaphorical brain, a simple mistake. Forgive me, please, sir.
Longface vanished down the hole, like smoke in the wind.
I stood there for a moment, plastic flashlight in hand. Komichi? How could my sister's name come up here, of all places? Could she be connected to this strangeness? But I had no time to ponder that question. I switched the flashlight on and entered the hole, feet first. It was dark below, and there seemed to be a long path sloping downward. That was odd, too, come to think of it. The room was on the third floor, so the second floor should be directly beneath. I trained the flashlight on the path, but couldn't make out where it led. I lowered the rest of my body inside and closed the lid tight behind me. Now everything was black. The darkness was so complete that my five senses were useless, as if the links between my body and my mind had been severed and no information was passing between them. It was the strangest feeling, as if I were no longer myself. Nevertheless, I had to go on. If my friends wished to save Maria Akikawa, then do the deed. Those had been the commendatore's words. He had made the sacrifice. Now it was my turn to face the ordeal. I had to push forward. With the flashlight my only ally, I stepped down into the inky blackness of the path of metaphor.
Chapter 53. Maybe a fireplace poker. The blackness enfolding me was so thick, so complete, it seemed to have a will of its own. It felt like walking on the ocean floor, where not even a particle of light could penetrate. Only the yellow beam of my flashlight connected me to the world, and barely at that. The passageway descended at a steady angle. The surface beneath my feet was hard and smooth. It felt like walking down a tunnel bored into solid rock. The ceiling was so low I had to stoop to keep from hitting my head. The air was chilly and odorless, and the total lack of smell disturbed me. Perhaps even the air was different here than above ground. How long would my flashlight hold out? Its beam was strong and steady for now, but when the batteries failed, as they would eventually, I would be stranded in the dark. And if I were to believe Longface, dangerous double metaphors were lurking out there, ready to pounce. The palm of my hand that held the flashlight was sweaty from the tension. My heartbeat was a dull, hard thump. It sounded threatening, like a drumbeat would to someone lost in the jungle. Longface had warned me, "Take a light of some kind with you. You will pass through many dark places on your way." So not everything in this passageway was pitch black. I wished it would brighten soon. I wished, too, that the ceiling would rise. I had always felt panicky in dark, constricted spaces. If this continued for much longer, I would soon have trouble breathing. To calm myself, I tried to focus on other things. I needed to find something, anything, to occupy my mind. What popped into my head was an open-faced grilled cheese sandwich. Why a grilled cheese sandwich? Go figure. That's what came up first, for whatever reason. Perfectly melted cheese on a square of beautifully browned toast, sitting on a pure white plate. So real, I could reach out and touch it. And beside it,
a cup of piping hot coffee, coffee as black as a moonless night, a window opening onto a tall willow, on whose supple branches a small flock of chirping birds perched precariously, like a troop of tightrope walkers. Everything at an immeasurable distance from where I was now. Then, for some reason, I thought of the opera Der Rosenkavalier. I would listen to it as I sipped my coffee and nibbled my grilled cheese sandwich. That jet black vinyl disc released by Decca Records in Great Britain. I placed the heavy record on the turntable and gently lowered the needle. Georg Schulte conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. The music elegant, intricate. When Richard Strauss had boasted he could describe even a broom musically, he was in his heyday. But was it a broom? I still couldn't remember. Perhaps it was an umbrella. Or then, again, maybe a fireplace poker. In any case, how could one describe a broom in music? Or a hot grilled cheese sandwich? Or someone's calloused feet? Or the difference between a simile and a metaphor? Could music really depict those things? Richard Strauss conducted the same orchestra in pre-war Vienna. Was it before the Anschluss? After? The program on this given day was Beethoven's Seventh, a resolute yet quiet and well-groomed symphony, squeezed between its bright, uninhibited older sister, the Sixth, and its bashful and beautiful younger sister, the Eighth. A youthful Tomohiko Amada was in attendance. A pretty young woman sat beside him. Most likely, he was in love with her. I imagined the city of Vienna on that day. The waltzes, the sweet Sachertorts, the red and black swastikas fluttering from the roofs. I could feel my thoughts veering off in a pointless direction, or more accurately perhaps, in a directionless direction. Yet I was powerless to rein them in. They were no longer under my control. It's no simple matter to hold on to your mind in total blackness. Your thoughts become a tree of riddles whose branches trail off into the dark, a metaphor. Nevertheless, I had to focus on something to hold myself together. Any old something would do. Otherwise, I would start to hyperventilate. One absurdity after another sauntered through my mind as I pushed down the endless slope. The passageway was as straight as an arrow, with no bends or forks. However far I walked, nothing changed, not the height of the ceiling, or the depth of the darkness, or the quality of the air, or the angle of the slope. My sense of time was foggy, but based on how long I had been walking, I must have been deep underground. Yet, in the end, that depth had to be a fabrication. After all, I had entered this tunnel from the third floor of a building. The darkness, too, had to be fabricated. Everything was either concept or metaphor, nothing more. That's what I told myself, anyway. The problem was that the darkness enfolding me was real darkness. The depth pressing down on me, real depth. Just when my neck and back were firing off warning signals about my hunched-over posture, a dim light appeared ahead. Then came a series of twists and turns. With each, my surroundings grew a little brighter, as if the night sky was giving way to day. Now I could make out where I was. I switched off my flashlight to conserve the batteries. It was growing light, but still I smelled nothing, heard nothing. Then, at last, the cramped passage abruptly ended, and I stepped out into the open. Yet I could see no sky above me, only what looked like a milky white ceiling far overhead. A pale glow covered everything, as if the world was lit by a host of luminous insects. It felt odd, yet it was a relief to say goodbye to the darkness, and to be able to walk upright again. I could relax a bit.
Outside the tunnel, the ground was rough underfoot. There was no path, only a barren, rocky plain that stretched